More biblical holidays, Jesus and Passover. We're going to start with looking at a biblical context for Passover, so turn to Exodus 12. And you can follow along, kind of scan some of these verses that I'm and points that I'm bringing out here. And a lot of this is review. You're familiar with these things. And the biblical context for Passover out of Exodus 12. So here in verse 2, God is talking to Moses and Aaron while they're still in Egypt, letting them know what's going to happen and how they're supposed to kind of proceed through the next days and then also on into their future. And he says, "This month shall be for you the beginning of months." So this is interesting because this is not January for us. It's like March, April for us. It's the Jewish month of Abib. And particularly on the 14th day of this month would be the beginning of this Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread. Passover happening on the 14th and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread continuing from the 15th on to the 21st. So this is what marks the beginning of Israel's religious calendar. It's not the day that we know today as Rosh Hashanah, which is another way of viewing, perhaps kind of a political beginning of the year, but as far as the religious beginning of the year, begins with this month of Aviv and with Passover. On Passover, and particularly with this first Passover, they would take a one-year-old unblemished lamb. I was going to put, or a kid here, but that would have sounded potentially problematic. So a goat kid, not a adult goat, but a kid. So either an unblemished lamb or a kid goat would be sacrificed. You know this. The blood of this lamb or goat would be spilled out and collected and then taken with some hyssop and applied to the doorpost and lintel of the house of the Jews. Along with this, then the body of the lamb would be roasted and eaten with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. And we'll talk a little bit about the bitter herbs here in a little bit. But the idea behind the unleavened bread and the bitter herbs, generally speaking, is that they're eating this with haste because they've got to be prepared, ready to get out of the land of Egypt because this final plague is going to lead Pharaoh to say, "Get out of here." And so when he says that, they got to get out fast. And so this unleavened bread, the bitter herbs, expressing that, but also unleavened bread, also communicating kind of metaphorically the idea of the removal of sin, leaven, sometimes representing uncleanness or sin. And so that's present there, but we'll talk about that more later. So with this final plague and the beginning of Passover, God would pass through Egypt and kill the firstborn of all of the families in Egypt, but he would pass over the houses of the Jews that had blood applied to the doorposts and lintel. And so this is where the terminology of Passover comes from. God's going to pass through Egypt, kill the firstborn. He's going to pass over the houses of the people of Israel that have applied the blood to their doors. So Israel's firstborn would be redeemed. And this is something that we read more about here in Exodus, and how the firstborn of Israel would be redeemed later. In this first incident, they would be redeemed because the blood has been applied and God would not kill the firstborn. But as a reminder of that, Israel would go through various ceremonies with their animals and even with their children to acknowledge that God had spared their firstborn. It would later turn into a giving of money. So not the life of their firstborn child, obviously, but they were sacrificing the firstborn of their animals. And so this was a constant reminder of what God had done in delivering their firstborn and continuing to do so. These firstborn would belong to God. So this is what was happening on the first Passover, and it would continue. It would be a memorial day to be kept as a, this should say feast, not fast. And so this is something they would remember year to year and observe year to year so as to remember what God had done for them in this final plague that led them out of Egypt and also protecting them in the face of this final plague. This feast would include eating unleavened bread for 7 days. There would be no work, and also a convocation or a holy assembly on days 1 and 7, so the people would gather together. So there's religious remembrance, there's religious observance going on, as well as this feast that's going on throughout these 7 days. And something else that's mentioned here is it's only going to be for those who are circumcised. And so this is something particular for the people of Israel, for God's people. It doesn't have relevance for those who aren't God's people, and so it would only be observed by those who have taken this mark upon them to say that they are God's people. Exodus 12 is the historical basis for Passover. And so if you want to know about Passover, a very important place to go to learn about it is Exodus 12, expressing what the final plague is about. What the people of Israel would do so that their firstborn children would not be killed, and then how that was going to be observed perpetually from year to year so as to remember this event and God's deliverance of them from Egypt and sparing their firstborn children. Any questions on Exodus 12? It's a bit of a summary there for you. There's more in there, but... All right, let's move on to another Old Testament passage that talks about Passover. We've been in this chapter before, Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16 talks about the three pilgrimage feasts, Passover and unleavened bread following it, and also the feasts of weeks and the feast of booths, and talks about Passover in verses 1 through 8. So something else that's included here, which is significant because, remember, Deuteronomy is Moses repeating the covenant, giving the instructions for the new generation of the people of Israel before they cross over into the Promised Land. And once they cross over into the Promised Land, then God is going to choose a place for His name to dwell. Initially, that wasn't Jerusalem, but it becomes Jerusalem later. And so the sacrifice of the lamb or the kid, the goat, was to be offered at the place God would choose to make His name dwell. Again, this ultimately ends up being Jerusalem. Originally, was Shiloh once they had entered the Promised Land. So a specific place where Passover, the whole of Passover, was to be observed rather than in all of the cities throughout the land of Israel. So that's new information. Didn't specifically apply while they were in the wilderness, but it's going to apply now that they're in the land. It's also stated here in these verses that this is being observed so that they would always remember God's deliverance of them from Egypt. And this is important for this new generation. They had been, at best, children, some of them, when the actual Exodus happened. For many of them hadn't even been born. And so Passover would be an enactment of what had happened, which was the redemption of the people of Israel from Egypt, a very significant historical marker in their life as a nation. So Passover was very important and remains very important to the people of Israel for that reason, because it's kind of not necessarily would say the birth of the nation, because that happens earlier with Abraham and his descendants, with Isaac and Jacob. But this is the redemption of the nation, getting them out of slavery and bringing them into their land. Numbers 9, so we're skipping back, also talks about the Passover sacrifices. And so that's significant. There were some... The next passage is talking about that. Numbers 9 is talking about when Passover celebrated the second time. And so the first time is when they leave the land of Egypt. The second time is in the second year. And so Numbers 9 talks about them observing Passover on this occasion before they leave Sinai to head towards the Promised Land. one thing that happens here is that there are some men that were unclean because they'd come in contact with a dead body, something like that, unavoidable. And so the question is raised, can we observe Passover at another time? And so here it's stated that Passover could be observed on the 14th day of the second month if one was away from the people, from the place where Passover was being observed, or if he was unclean because of something outside of his control. So that's interesting to note. But on the other side, those who could observe it, so they weren't on a journey and they weren't unclean, if they didn't observe Passover, they would be cut off from the people of Israel. So that's a very significant thing. This is mandated for the people of Israel, very important for them to be observing, obeying these commands of God related to Passover. Now one more passage from the Old Testament. That's Numbers 28. I might want to flip over there and just kind of scan over it if you like. But Numbers 28, 16 through 25 lays out some special burnt offerings and grain offerings that were to be made surrounding Passover. And so this chapter in general covers various offerings the people of Israel were to give to God. And included here are some Passover offerings. And so we know that besides the special meal they were observing on Passover, the sacrifice of the lamb, and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread. This is something else that was going on. These burnt offerings and grain offerings expressing this commitment to God. It's the idea of the burnt offering is a life or a people that are wholly given over to God. And the grain offering is an expression of God having provided these things for us, and we are acknowledging Him as our provider, and then giving these things back to Him in thanks. And so these things were happening during Passover as well. Okay, that's the biblical context for Passover. Questions or comments on any of that? Fairly familiar stuff for us. All right, so a few things regarding the Jewish observance of Passover. This is something that's required in the Scriptures of the men, not of everybody, but of the men every year to go to Jerusalem for Passover and also these other pilgrimage feasts. It does seem that this did not happen on a regular basis for all of the men every year to go to all three of these feasts. But the pious Jews would attempt to go to Jerusalem. And a good example of this is in Luke 2, where we read about Jesus' parents, Joseph and Mary, having this as a custom, that they would go to Jerusalem every year for the Passover, and Jesus went with them. So the pious Jews would attempt to go to Jerusalem, which would cause Jerusalem's occupancy to swell greatly. This is something that's interesting to think about when you're thinking through the gospel stories and Jesus being present in Jerusalem, especially when he was arrested, tried, crucified, that Jerusalem's inhabitants, there would have been many more during this time because of those who had come from other cities to Jerusalem to observe Passover. And this is also significant, helping to explain what's happening with the crowds that are acclaiming Jesus, accepting Jesus. And a lot of those would have been some of those people from the other parts of Israel, especially northern Israel, so Galilee, where Jesus had enjoyed greater success, coming to Jerusalem as well and following him and acclaiming him, whereas many in Jerusalem, led by the religious leaders, were the ones rejecting him. So that's helpful to remember what's going on in Jerusalem around Passover, which is around the time of Jesus' sacrifice. Another thing we know is that Jews would very scrupulously try to get rid of any remaining crumbs that would be leavened in their house. So they'd get rid of any leaven, yeast, we would say, as well as just anything that they could find in their house that was even really crumbs. They would sweep these things clear. So they were very scrupulous about this, and this is not surprising. I'm just knowing the way that Jews viewed these things and sticking very closely to the letter of the law. On the 13th day, a lamb would be taken to the temple. And so this is what we think of as, so this is like the morning of the day when they would have the meal. But because sundown marks a new day for them, it's the previous day. So for us, same day. For them, previous day, they would take the lamb to the temple where it would be inspected by the Levites, and assuming everything was good, that it was an unblemished lamb or kid, then they would slaughter the animal. Its blood would be poured out and collected and poured out at the altar. So sacrificed in a sense that way. Also the kidneys and liver would be removed and burned, kind of as this offering to God. But the rest of the body would be returned to the family to be taken and roasted and eaten. And so sometimes this would just be one family, or there would be sometimes multiple families that would come together and eat this lamb. And everything that wasn't eaten had to be gotten rid of as well. So none was left over. And so that explains why there might have been more than one family taking part in the meal. The modern Seder that we think of, that Orthodox Jews are observing today, and that many Christians are familiar with, and this word Seder has the idea of an order. The modern order of the Passover meal was developed after the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And so that doesn't go back into Old Testament times, obviously, and doesn't even go back to the time of Christ. So it's a generation after the time of Christ, towards the end of our New Testament time period, when this Passover Seder that we're familiar with was put into place. And even that being the case, it's been modified over the years. And so what's observed by Jews today is not necessarily exactly what they were doing in the late part of the first century. So what we know of today doesn't go all the way back to the time of Christ and the apostles, but close. And it's just worth noting that what we see them doing is not exactly necessarily what's happening at the Lord's Supper, those kinds of things. Questions? Wait, I got one more slide. Sorry. It's a short one. So going back to Jesus' day, from the historical evidence that we can find, it seems like the meal was probably ordered around these elements. Four cups that were shared by the people. Also the singing of the Hallel Psalms, which are Psalms 113 through 118. And then eating bitter herbs, unleavened bread, and something else that's not expressed in the Old Testament. We've already seen them talking about bitter herbs and unleavened bread, but not this other thing, hariset, which apparently was in its composition reminded of the mortar in the bricks that they used when they were building these things for the Egyptians under slavery. And so each of these things has significance to it. The bitter herbs reminding them of the bitterness of their slavery in Egypt and how hard it was, and for those of future generations, how hard it would have been to have been in slavery in Egypt. The unleavened bread reminding them of the importance of cleanness, but also the haste with which they left the land of Egypt. They didn't have time to wait for their bread to leaven. And so they had to just make the unleavened kind, which is not as enjoyable to eat either. And so it's a reminder of that flight from Egypt. So along with these things, as you might expect, the Passover story would be recounted through these various symbols, speaking for the sake of all involved, but especially the children, what God had done and bringing his people out of the land of Egypt into the promised land. So that's, to some degree, how the Jews observe Passover today and how they have historically. And perhaps you're familiar with some of those elements. Questions or comments on that? Yes. I would need to research that a little bit more. I didn't spend a lot of time in that section. I don't know if it explains it. But in general, those were often the organs that would be consumed in burnt offerings to God. And so that's not just specific to the Passover offering, but was part of other offerings that were given to God, that these particular organs would be taken out of the body of the animal and burned up. So it's interesting because, and this is characteristic of some of the other offerings, that part of the offering was the people, or in other cases, the priests or the Levites, eating the animal. And so that's a gracious thing from God that he would accept as an offering their enjoyment of this meal. But in other cases, there were things that were not to be given to the people. They were dedicated to God only, including, what I say here, the kidney and the livers. Is that right? Well, one liver per animal, kidney and the liver. So I'd have to look into that a little bit further to see if there's more expressed of the significance of it. But in the other sacrifices, that's kind of the idea. This is God's portion, and the rest is your portion.
It's interesting, too, that
they are the purifiers of blood. Sure. Yeah. And so blood is very significant in the sacrifices. And in the surrounding nations, something that they would do in their paganism was take the blood for themselves. Partly, perhaps, because of their enjoyment of it, but also because of what it symbolized, kind of a power over the animal and taking that power into yourself. And God would not allow the people of Israel to do that because the life was in the blood, and so these two organs in particular were closely tied to blood. And so that would be some explanation for it. Any other questions, comments on this? Lauren? Yes, and if you got the book, you can read through that section and it identifies what they probably were. Okay. You can read over it and you'll notice it. There's a... okay. I could probably pull it up real quick. Potentially. Save you some time. Oh, it's going to be stuck in my head now. So I'm not going to be able to move on. All right, so the first may have been the Kiddush, or the Cup of Holiness. The second, the Magid, retelling of the Passover story. The third, the Birkat Hamazon, for blessings. And the fourth, the Hallel, for praise. So I'll reference this in just a minute with regard to the Last Supper as well. Okay, let's move on to Jesus and the Passover. So in the Synoptic Gospels, there are two references to the Passover. The first one, anybody know where it is? I said something about it earlier, a few minutes ago. There are two references, yeah, Luke 2. Two references to the Passover in the Synoptic Gospels, and one of them I already said, and Paul knew it or was listening, I don't know. So Luke 2, verses 41 through 43, this childhood narrative of Jesus, the only childhood narrative of Jesus, happens during Passover. So now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. When he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. We know the rest of the story. He goes to the temple and is asking questions of the teachers there, and they're amazed by his understanding. But this indicates that Jesus' family was a pious Jewish family, and so he was familiar with this from a very early age, and we wouldn't be surprised that this is something that continued throughout his life, that every year he went to Jerusalem for Passover. We don't know that for sure, but it was the custom of his parents, and in John's Gospel, it seems to have been the custom, his custom, at least during the years of his public ministry. We'll come to that in just a moment. The only other reference in the Synoptic Gospels is the obvious one, and that's the Passion Week. So the Synoptics don't have a lot to say, about the Passover, or maybe I should say it this way, as much to say about it as John's Gospel does. John, besides Luke 2's mention, has three mentions of Passover. First one is in chapter 2, verse 13 and following. And in this instance, Jesus is in Jerusalem, and he goes to the temple and drives the money changers out of the temple. The money changers would have been especially active during Passover, exchanging money for the sake of buying what was needed for the Passover meal. And so this is the occasion in which Jesus cleansed the temple and then talked about destroying the temple and rebuilding it in 3 days. And John tells us that he wasn't talking about the physical temple, but his own body. This is something that very early on, remember this is John 2, is stirring up opposition to Jesus. Because this is something they prized highly. It was something that had been built over a number of years, completed by Herod. And so they're both surprised and offended by Jesus saying he would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Something even later on that they would use in accusations against him. So there's the first mention of Jesus in Jerusalem at Passover during his public ministry. The second is in chapter 6, and we're going to come back to this passage in a moment. This is where Jesus miraculously fed 5,000 men plus women and children. And it's also in kind of response to that, in the context of that, that he gives the great bread of life discourse, referring to himself as the bread of life. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. And then one more narrative, and that is the Passion narrative, beginning in chapter 11 of John's Gospel and continuing through Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, which that in itself reveals something to you about John's Gospel that really over half of it is concerned with basically 1 week of Jesus' life. It's an interesting thing to note. John's Gospel is not a typical biography as we would think of it, but is especially on purpose focused on just 1 week of Jesus' life, and even more specifically, just a couple of days of Jesus' life. So, getting into John 6, looking at Jesus' Passover miracle. And by the way, this is why we think of Jesus' public ministry being 3 years long. This is something that's commonly thought of, that Jesus, I think it's Mark, says he began his public ministry around the age of 30. And so that's why we think that he probably began his ministry or public ministry around the age of 30, conducted it for 3 years, and died around the age of 33. That's why, because of John's mention of these three separate Passovers. Okay, so Jesus' Passover miracle in John 6. So he's feeding 5,000 men plus women and children, and the fact that it was Passover is some explanation for why such a large crowd. Remember, there were large crowds in Jerusalem around the time of Passover. And John 6 mentions to us that this happened during the Passover season. So it's an occasion for a large crowd, Passover is. And this large crowd is also an occasion for a miracle. Because Jesus is teaching them, the Synoptic Gospels tell us, all day. And so they're very hungry, and there's nowhere to easily get food for this amount of people. And so Jesus has opportunity to provide for a need, which he does so miraculously by providing bread and fish, we know. But the emphasis here is on the bread. That's important because of the discourse that follows. And so the people respond this way, seeing this impressive miracle at the time of Passover. So they've got Passover ideas running through their head, and they see Jesus miraculously providing for 5,000 men plus women and children. And their conclusion is, this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. You know what they're referring to here? Where in the Old Testament does it talk about a prophet who's going to come into the world? Go back. Backwards. Forwards. What was that, Dami? Deuteronomy, yes. In chapter 18, verse 15, Moses says this to the people. Oh no, I got a weird formatting thing going on. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen. And so Moses is saying, I'm passing off the scene. That's happening in Deuteronomy. But there is going to be another prophet that comes after me. Perhaps some reference to Joshua and other prophets beyond him. But the people of Israel recognized this as a prophecy of a great prophet that was going to come. And they connected this with the Messiah. And so they're thinking in messianic terms, and they're also referring back to Moses' own prophecy. They're thinking of Moses as well. And so, I don't know how much of it we're going to be able to see here. But as God had provided manna through Moses, now God had provided for this large crowd miraculously through Jesus. So there's some similarities going on, some parallels. There is provision of bread that's connected with Passover. We know that Passover involves unleavened bread and is followed by the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so that's one of the ideas swirling in the minds of the people. Bread, God's provision for them. This is happening in what Jesus is doing for the 5,000 plus. And there are other Exodus, and with Exodus, Passover, so not just this specific day of Passover, but what it leads into, themes in the context of John 6. And so some of these things are pointed out by the author in the book here. Some of these things are perhaps speculative, but also there's some evidence here that John's doing it intentionally. And you know, by the way, John's gospel is kind of unique in this sense that John often seems to be alluding to Old Testament images without coming right out and saying it. So John 1 is a great example. In John 1, there are allusions back to creation. And it's not right on the face of it, but when you think through it, I'm talking about light and darkness and creation and, you know, before, in the beginning. That's how John 1 starts. In the beginning was the Word. Genesis 1:1 starts with, in the beginning. And so John seems to be intentionally doing this kind of in a, I don't want to say veiled way, but in an implicit way throughout his gospel, showing how Jesus fulfills a lot of Old Testament themes. And so it shouldn't be surprising that in a passage like this, he'd be doing the same thing. I think you're only going to get a couple of these because the formatting got messed up. But we have a miracle on the sea that follows this provision of bread. And so that's interesting. You know, just as the people of Israel went through the Red Sea, we have Jesus and his disciples out on the Sea of Galilee in a storm. Is it the Sea of Galilee? Let me look real quick. Nope, I don't know. Across the sea to Capernaum. Somebody else can look into that. If you got notes, you can tell me which sea it was. I want to say something wrong here. Probably that's the main sea in Israel. But anyway, a stormy sea, and Jesus walks on the water. You know, similar to what happened with the people of Israel. They didn't walk on the water. They walked through the dry ground. But you know, the ability to do something you wouldn't otherwise be able to do in a dangerous situation. And so perhaps an allusion back to Exodus themes there. There's also even grumbling that happens here kind of in the later part of this chapter with the way the Jews respond to Jesus talking about himself as the bread of life. And this terminology calls to mind the people of Israel grumbling over how God provided for them in the wilderness. That they grumbled because they didn't have meat. They grumbled because they didn't have water. This is a repeated thing. They grumbled against Moses, and now they're grumbling against Jesus. And again, it seems like John is intentionally making these ties to show that Jesus is this great prophet that Moses had prophesied, who's greater than Moses, and who also is the one providing manna for them, providing bread for them. So that's visually represented in the feeding of the 5,000 plus, but is spiritually expressed in Jesus' bread of life discourse. So let's go there now. The bread of life discourse here in John 6. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. He explains that he would give them the food that endures to eternal life. It's not referring to normal food. It's obviously a metaphorical expression of giving them what they need to have life and to be satisfied. That Jesus is going to do this for them. As Moses had done this for them, or as God had done this through Moses for them in the wilderness. And so the Jews are thinking about these things. These ideas are in their minds. And they refer to God's provision of manna. And so, comparing what Jesus is saying to how God had provided manna for the people of Israel in the wilderness, these ideas are in their minds. Jesus responded and said, "My Father gives you the true bread from heaven." So something better than the bread that they've received. And just as the manna came down from heaven seemingly to the people of Israel, so Jesus, as the bread of life, has been sent down by the Father to these people. He explains the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. So he's clearly identifying himself, paralleling himself with the manna that God had given to the people in the wilderness. He says very directly, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst." This isn't talking physical terms. People come to Christ and still get hungry and still get thirsty. I'm thirsty right now. That's not a request for water. I'm just saying. He's talking in spiritual terms, that your spiritual longings are satisfied when you come to Christ forever. Your longing for spiritual life is met in Jesus Christ, and the bread of life. Then he goes on and says something that's that the people become very offended by. It says, "Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day, for my flesh is true food and my blood is true drink." And the people are thinking in very physical terms, how are you going to give us your flesh to eat? And that sounds disgusting. And the idea of his blood to drink is very offensive to the Jews, because remember, God doesn't allow them to take in blood. And Jesus is saying, "I'm going to give you my body and my blood to give you spiritual life forever." And obviously, we know he's talking in spiritual terms, and that these things are received through faith. But with these ideas that Jesus is expressing, there is Passover meal imagery running through these words, with the cup, with the bread. And this is happening during the Passover time, the discussion of manna and Moses. And so all these ideas are combining together to communicate what Jesus is. He is the one who's fulfilling Passover. Make sense? Understanding Passover enriches your understanding of John 6. An awesome passage in its own right that becomes even awesomer when you understand some of these things. All right, I got to hurry on. Jesus' Passover meal. So I'm talking about the Last Supper. This is referred to in all of the Gospel accounts. Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22 has the longest retelling of it among the synoptics. And then John doesn't focus on the institution of the Lord's Supper, but talks about what happened at the Lord's Supper for five chapters. So there's a lot of focus on Jesus' Passover meal. We know from all these accounts that Jesus and his disciples were observing Passover in Jerusalem. Jesus sent them out to make preparations. They were eating within the city limits as they were supposed to. They had this upper room that had been reserved and furnished for them. So a lamb would have been included in this meal, but it's not mentioned. So that's interesting. You know, perhaps this is intentionally the case because the important lamb is not the one they're eating, but the one that they're eating with. And so the focus is not on the lamb, but on the bread and on the cup. But from all we can see, this was a normal Passover observance, so there would have been a lamb involved. Luke's account refers to two cups. So this can be a bit confusing because in Luke's account, before the bread is mentioned, there's a cup mentioned. But there's also another cup mentioned after the bread. And so Luke is mentioning two cups, which is probably reflecting the following of that established pattern we were talking about, the four cups that the Jews seem to have been observing in their meal, the Passover meal. And so the author speculates that the second cup that's referred to is perhaps the third cup, which, can I bring it up again quickly, would have been the cup of blessing. And what Paul has to say about this in 1 Corinthians may suggest that. He talks about the cup of blessing that we give. And so it may indicate that the cup that was used instituting the Lord's Supper was the third cup, and perhaps there was no fourth cup, which the author is speculating. Perhaps it's suggestive of we don't drink that fourth cup until we do so in Christ's presence in His kingdom. It's kind of a cool idea, but it's unfortunate that it's speculative, so don't get too excited about it, but you can be interested in it. Which would mean that the first cup that's referenced by Luke would have been the second cup, which, now I'm not going to turn back there. I think might have been the, I don't know. So, Jesus then, if we've already talked about this earlier cup, he breaks the bread and says, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Something that would have been happening in the Passover meal, passing around the bread, and Jesus is saying, "Now this is my body." There's something better than just the bread you're taking in here, or even what it's representing from the Old Testament narrative, but my body itself is what's going to satisfy you. And then he gave the cup and said, "This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood." And so the new covenant is being established here, replacing, fulfilling the old covenant. And so the cup is representing Jesus' blood that's poured out to ratify this new covenant, to purchase this new covenant for them. They concluded with praise. And remember this, after they had done this, they sing a hymn and go out to the Mount of Olives, and then eventually to the Garden of Gethsemane, where they continued in prayer, Jesus, while the others slept. But this is a common thing for the Jews, that they would also, as we said, finish with the cup of praise. And so this would be the end of the meal for them. And it was also common for them to spend the rest of the evening in prayer. And so Jesus seems to be following a typical Jewish pattern in what happened with the Last Supper. What's significant to note here is that the Passover meal has now become the Lord's Supper. What Jesus is doing with this supper now is more important than the Passover, because he's fulfilled the Passover. He's instituting something new, something better. Oh my goodness. Okay, I got to keep going, but I'll do so fast. Jesus' Passover sacrifice. So this is obviously referring to Jesus' arrest, trials, crucifixion, all happening at the time of Passover. There is some debate over the timing of Jesus' death. Some people would say that he died not on Friday as we know it, but on Thursday. And the reason they say this is because that's when the Passover lambs were killed. And so they go back and try to find evidence that Jesus might have been killed on Thursday as well. If that's the case, then either the meal was out of typical order. So why do I say that? Because Jesus observed the meal, and that would have included a sacrificed lamb. And Jesus died after the meal. And so either they ate the meal out of order, or Jesus' death was on Friday as traditionally understood. That's my inclination, is that Jesus did die on Friday. Also, because of what's said that the next day was a Sabbath day, so that Passover fell in this case right before a Sabbath, and so they needed to get his body down off the cross before the Sabbath so they wouldn't be unclean on the Sabbath. So I think it was probably on Friday, but there's some good arguments that it happened on Thursday to make his death line up with when the Passover lambs would have been killed. But either way, he's dying around Passover, and that's quite obvious. It's Interesting to note that in the Jewish reckoning of things, the meal, which happened on Thursday night, and the crucifixion were on the same day. Not in the way we think of it. We think of it as Thursday and Friday, but for the Jews, they think of it as the same day. And so that's noteworthy, that this meal and Jesus' sacrifice, which represents the meal, happened on the same day. Jesus has been identified as the Lamb of God, and he had predicted his death as a sacrifice. John the Baptist's words regarding this is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world come to mind. And so those ideas are present as Jesus dies on the cross. Here's another interesting little point. A hyssop branch was used to offer him sour wine, according to John 19. And hyssop was involved in the Passover, is involved in the Passover observance by Jews, going back to the hyssop being used to apply the blood to the doorposts and lintels when they were back in Egypt. So that's interesting. Also, his legs were not broken, as was forbidden for sacrificial lambs. This was what happened to the others who were crucified with him, so that they would asphyxiate and die. But Jesus had already given up his life, and so there was no need to break his legs, and so they weren't, which preserved the image of this unblemished sacrifice. Also then, his blood was poured out. This happened obviously during his sufferings, but also when the spear was jammed into his side. This also is what would happen with the sacrificial lamb, as we've already talked about. Probably familiar with these passages, 1 Corinthians 5:7. Paul says, "Cleanse out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, as you really are unleavened." You're clean. You're not contaminated anymore. "For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed." So the Christians were recognizing this imagery rather clearly. 1 Peter 1:18 through 19, another familiar passage. "You were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb, without blemish or spot." And so we also recognize Jesus' identity as the great Passover lamb and love the image. What's really cool is in Revelation, Jesus is most frequently referred to as the Lamb. In fact, he's referred to with that title 29 times in the book of Revelation. That's kind of surprising, because you would think that in his glorified state, he would be referred to with a glorious name. And Lamb is a glorious name for Jesus because of what he is. All right, so some contemporary relevance. Understanding Passover increases our understanding and appreciation of Jesus' work. A lot of those images are involved in what he did. Seeing his work as fulfilling the themes of Exodus just expands how great what he did is. Recognizing his supper as fulfilling themes of the Passover meal enriches our observance of the Lord's Supper. There's Passover imagery that's involved in the Lord's Supper. And so, how should we observe these things today? I think that the Passion Week is a great opportunity for us still today to reflect on God's redemption of us in Christ Jesus, thinking back to Passover themes that have now been fulfilled by what Jesus has done, especially with Good Friday and Resurrection Sunday. You may be familiar with the fact that each of the days in Passion Week is significant in some of the highly liturgical churches, but especially Good Friday and Resurrection Sunday. The Lord's Supper also is a great opportunity to reflect on Jesus' sacrifice for us and his provision of life. This is so cool that we don't have a Passover meal once a year, but every time we observe the Lord's Supper, we are kind of taking part in a Passover meal. And so we could say it this way: Jesus has fulfilled Passover. Everything that it was pointing to, he himself has fulfilled in a much greater way. And so that makes Passover observance optional. This is quite clear in the New Testament. It's not forbidden, but it's also not mandated, so it's optional, but it's been transformed. Its meaning is no longer Old Testament type meaning. Its meaning has to include what Jesus has now done. that we know that. And so whenever Passover is observed by Christians, it should be transformed. We shouldn't be sacrificing lambs, no longer needed because Jesus is a once-for-all sacrifice. And it's been replaced by the Lord's Supper. And so we have something more frequent and better in the Lord's Supper. All right, I'm way, way over time. Sorry. I started late. A lot to get in. If I bled over to next week, we'd be in trouble. So, final questions or thoughts on any of this? Hope that's helpful.